Today is June 17th, 2026. This is your geopolitics briefing for Macro Observer. In the next 8 to 10 minutes, we'll cover Ukraine's indigenous cruise missile striking deep into Russian industrial territory and what that means for Moscow's strategic calculus, the NATO proposal for $80 billion in military aid to Ukraine, and the contested U.S.-Iran nuclear framework whose terms Washington and Tehran cannot even agree on. Let's start with a number that reframes everything happening on the battlefield right now, 885 kilometers. That is the distance from Ukrainian territory to the Dnieper Progress plant in Cheboksary, a defense industrial facility in the Chuvashia Republic, deep in the Russian interior, that manufactures Shahed drone components, Iskander missile parts, and critically, Kometa satellite navigation modules. On June 10th, Ukraine's indigenously developed fluorine monophosphide 5 Flamingo cruise missile struck that plant. The International Institute for Strategic Studies has characterized the Flamingo as carrying a warhead of approximately 1,150 kilograms, with a nominal range of up to 3,000 kilometers. The strike caused fires that Russian Telegram channels themselves described as producing substantial damage. The strategic calculus here is straightforward but profound. Russian planners have operated for years under a fundamental assumption that the Ural-adjacent industrial belt is a sanctuary zone beyond meaningful Ukrainian reach. That assumption is now operationally dead. And the Flamingo's demonstrated range doesn't merely threaten one facility. It theoretically places much of European Russia within targeting reach, so long as Ukraine can sustain operationally meaningful salvo volumes. Building on that, the Kometa navigation module produced at Vinir is assessed by Defense Express as critical to maintaining Shahed drone course correction under electronic warfare conditions. If that supply chain is disrupted, analysts project observable degradation in Russian drone campaign effectiveness within a 60 to 90 day horizon, a window that maps almost precisely onto the autumn buildup toward Ukraine's winter heating season. The timing is not coincidental. The same night as the Cheboksary strike, Ukraine's first separate unmanned system center publicly claimed responsibility for AN-196 drone strikes on the Kapatnya oil refinery in Moscow's southeastern district, approximately 15 kilometers from the Kremlin. And here is where the strategic weight becomes qualitatively different. Yulon Robkasir, political editor at Bild, reported on air that no air defense missile launches were visible in any circulating footage of the Kapatnya strike. None. This contrasts sharply with the visible, frantic Russian air defense response during the St. Petersburg Economic Forum period just weeks earlier. Russia's Kope Cage architecture, building-scale metal enclosures designed to prematurely detonate drone warheads, constructed around facilities like Vinir at significant cost and confirmed by satellite imagery, was rendered strategically obsolete in a single night. Ukraine simply shifted from drones to cruise missiles, and an entire class of passive defense infrastructure became irrelevant. That is a recurring pattern in military history. Static point defenses defeated by platform substitution. Robkasir reported that Kapotnya accounts for somewhere between 40 and 70% of petroleum product supply to Moscow City and the surrounding region. The figures vary depending on source, but either number indicates that a sustained outage generates visible civilian supply stress. More importantly, the psychological threshold crossed here is enormous. Moscow's population has experienced this war as a distant abstraction. That geographic firewall is now gone. President Zelensky also confirmed simultaneous strikes on the Kuibyshev oil refinery in Samara, over 900 kilometers from Ukraine, and two oil infrastructure facilities in the Vladimir region, approximately 700 kilometers distant. The shifting geography of power here is unmistakable. Ukraine is executing a coordinated multi-node campaign against Russian energy infrastructure that mirrors, at a doctrinal level, the Allied strategic bombing logic applied against German synthetic fuel production during the Second World War. Target the industrial substrate, degrade the logistics chain, force adaptation at scale. Russia faces the same imperative the Germans faced then: dispersal, redundancy, underground hardening. The Kope Cage's failure tells us Russian planners chose the wrong adaptation. For Ukraine, the doctrinal logic mirrors Israel's qualitative military edge doctrine, the deliberate development of indigenous precision strike capability, independent of external supply conditionality, treated as a strategic imperative. Ukraine has internalized that lesson. Defense Express reports that the fluorine monophosphide 7 ballistic missile program completed its second known test launch on June 4th, demonstrating guided flight capability for the first time. Military analyst Pavlo Narozhny assessed that once operational, Ukraine could produce several dozen fluorine monophosphide 7 missiles per month. The combination of subsonic Flamingo cruise missiles and ballistic fluorine monophosphide 7s creates a multi-vector interception problem that strains any static air defense architecture Moscow can assemble. Now let's move to the diplomatic dimension, because the military picture is unfolding inside a rapidly shifting Western commitment architecture. The G7 summit in France on June 16th produced something more than the usual communique language. President Zelensky presented President Trump with photographs of the June 15th Russian strike on the Kiev-Pechersk Lavra, a UNESCO World Heritage Site, an approximately 1,000-year-old monastery where at least 5 civilians were killed. Trump, according to one European diplomat quoted by Reuters, showed his disapproval. The same diplomat characterized the presentation as psychologically a good move by Zelensky. That framing matters. It suggests the American posture toward Moscow is shifting, however incrementally. G7 consensus included unanimity that Russia is not winning and must negotiate, expanded pressure via sanctions on oil, gas, banking, and military sectors, and support for strengthening Ukraine's air defense. Trump responded positively to Zelensky's request for additional Patriot interceptor missiles. No final public commitment, but a positive signal that requires translation into formal announcement within a 30 to 60-day window to carry operational weight for Ukraine's winter planning. More structurally significant development was reported by Politico, citing 4 anonymous NATO diplomats. A German-originated proposal circulating within the alliance would commit over $80 billion in military aid to Ukraine for 2026. Politico described it as edging closer to being agreed upon, with the Ankara summit in July identified as the formal ratification venue. The structural composition includes approximately $35 billion from the EU loan mechanism already committed, using frozen Russian sovereign assets as collateral, and approximately $45 billion in new bilateral aid from NATO member contributions. The strategic calculus here operates on 2 registers. The first is material. $80 billion represents the largest single-year Western aid commitment of the conflict, and it would directly enable Ukraine's drone production ambition. Deputy Defense Minister Mstislav Banik told the NATO Parliamentary Assembly that production could scale to 20 million units per year with adequate funding, against an estimated 4 million units produced in 2025. The second register is architectural. This proposal is explicitly designed to function independent of U.S. participation. That is a functional milestone in European strategic autonomy that would have been architecturally inconceivable in the pre-2022 European security landscape. The Kiel Institute's data is instructive here. In March and April of 2025, Germany allocated approximately $4.8 billion to Ukraine each month, primarily for air defenses and drones, while recording 0 new U.S. military aid disbursements during the same window. Europe is already compensating. The transparency mechanism embedded in Germany's proposal, making member contributions visible across the alliance, creates reputational incentives and political costs that the 2% GDP spending target, adopted over decades, never successfully generated at comparable speed. Building on that, German military chief Lieutenant General Christian Freuding stated on June 11th that all 32 NATO partners agree Russia might have the capability to invade a NATO partner country in 2029. He characterized this as NATO-agreed intelligence. Open-source corroboration comes from TVP World's reporting of Russian border infrastructure construction along Finland, Sweden, Norway, and the Baltic states. Facilities consistent with accommodating approximately 115,000 troops. This framing redefines the aid architecture entirely. It's not humanitarian obligation, it's forward defense investment. Underwriting a non-NATO partner absorbing Russian military capacity before it can be redirected westward. The third major development this week introduces the most structural uncertainty of all, the U.S.-Iran nuclear framework announced by President Trump. Rabobank global strategist Michael Every, speaking on Thoughtful Money within hours of the announcement, characterized it as a memorandum of misunderstanding, and his reasoning is worth unpacking carefully. The framework establishes a 60-day negotiating window focused on nuclear and other substantive issues, with the Strait of Hormuz reportedly scheduled to reopen within days. No treaty text was released. No binding terms were published. The only party releasing specific terms at the time of Every's recording was Iran's Fars News Agency, whose characterization directly contradicts the U.S. framing. Iran's version: no uranium surrender, no proxy dismantlement, a $300 billion reconstruction fund, and a U.S. exit from the regional enforcement role. Every assigned a probability of less than 50% to Iran having genuinely agreed to surrender enrichment capability, citing the sequential rollback of U.S. demands from regime change to ballistic missile elimination to proxy dismantlement down to uranium as the sole remaining stated red line. A progressive narrowing that suggests earlier demands were negotiated off the table one by one. Pakistan is serving as the sole intermediary as the U.S. and Iran refuse direct contact. Every assess this as introducing systematic signal distortion risk. Neither principle can verify fidelity of transmission. Trump simultaneously gave a New York Times interview stating that if Iran fails to agree to nuclear terms within the 60-day window, the U.S. would resume bombing, and separately floated the possibility of the U.S. becoming the overseer of the Middle East's oil in exchange for a 20% cut. The structural pattern EVRY identifies sequential demand rollback, procedural compliance, masking substantive noncompliance, domestic political constraints preventing honest accounting, closely mirrors the 2015 JCPOA's trajectory and eventual collapse. For the Gulf states and for China, the announcement carries a different message entirely. China announced the same weekend that Enbridge, an alternative cross-border payment system bypassing SWIFT and the U.S. dollar, would go live with Saudi Arabia's participation. The timing, EVRY assessed, was a direct signal of Chinese intent to build dollar alternative financial infrastructure in the Gulf. Oil prices declined only approximately 4% on the peace announcement, suggesting markets had already discounted much of the Hormuz risk premium. The indirect consequence for the Russia-Ukraine file is this: the framework freed U.S. diplomatic bandwidth for Trump to refocus attention on the conflict. A German journalist reported at the G7 that Trump listened and recognized Putin is now in a weaker position than before. If that perception holds, the dynamic shifts from U.S. pressure on Kyiv toward U.S. pressure on Moscow, a realignment with potentially significant consequences at the Ankara summit. One regional spotlight deserves mention before we close. Armenia's Prime Minister Nikol Pashinyan secured 49.8% of the vote on June 8th, with the Kremlin-backed Strong Armenia Alliance placing a distant second at 23.2%, less than half of Pashinyan's share. The OSCE described the election as transparent and efficient. Russia's pre-election coercive toolkit had reportedly included trade sanctions on Armenian wine, cognac, and cherries, an intensified disinformation campaign, and a reported plan to transport approximately 100,000 ethnic Armenian Russians into Armenia to vote, priced at $50 million. None of it worked. The result is the most recent data point in a pattern the FPRI has characterized as accelerating Russian soft power erosion: the fall of Assad in Syria, Moldova's westward drift, despite an alleged Russian expenditure of $220 million to influence its presidential election, and now Armenia's decisive rejection of the Russian-aligned platform. The empire of influence is contracting. In the next 48 hours, the signal to monitor most closely is vessel movement at the Strait of Hormuz. Ships queued outside the strait face a 30 to 45-day voyage decision window, and the 60-day U.S.-Iran framework means that operators need to decide now whether to transit well before the window closes. If vessel operators hold position rather than reversing course toward Hormuz, it signals that the commercial community has already priced the framework as a temporary pause rather than a durable resolution. That single data point will tell you more about how serious actors assess the Iran deal than any diplomatic statement from either capital. Stay vigilant. Until tomorrow. That's your core brief for today. Thanks for listening. We'll be back tomorrow with more.